you, dear listener, for tuning into Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into the fourth episode of Panopticon. Our guest tonight is Dr. Richard Spence, professor of history and chair at the University of Idaho. He specializes in Russian and Eastern European history, but also has developed a strong interest in the roles of espionage and occultism in history. His works include biographies of the Russian terrorist and political adventurer Boris Savinkov and the so-called Ace of Spies, Sidney Reilly. Today we'll be talking about his most recent book, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence, and the Occult. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Andy. It's my pleasure to be talking with you. Well, it's afternoon for me. I guess it's what, morning for you?
Yeah, mid-morning, and it's my pleasure as well.
Okay. I don't know. I guess brief introduction. My name is formerly Richard Spence. I usually go by Rick. I'm a professor of history at the University of Idaho, off in the, one of those squarish Rocky Mountain states. I live up in the little pointy part of it, the panhandle of Idaho. Perilously near the Canadian border, and right next to the Washington border. And I've been here for, almost 25 years, which astounds me in some cases. And I guess what we want to talk today is about a book I wrote a couple of years ago, coming up on that, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult, and I guess you want to ask me some questions about that.
Yeah, I just reread it, and it's fascinating. What led you into this topic?
Well, first of all, I had to have a kind of disclaimer, because Aleister Crowley is, I'm not sure he's, you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure that he's world famous, but it's fairly well known, and a lot of people know him, or they know something about him, and they have opinions about him. I am not. I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of any organization that could constitute me as a follower of Aleister Crowley. So one of the things that I argue in the introduction to the book, in fact, one of the first things in the book is sort of my description of how I came about coming to this topic, and telling people sort of up front what my view of it is, and I don't have any axe to grind for him or against him, so I didn't go into this project and write the book trying to set out to prove something one way or the other. I just like to see how things are going to develop.
Right.
I suppose I could say that I wasn't ignorant of him. I knew something about him. I knew something about his reputation. And I guess we may go further into this. I have to admit that in the end I was more than modestly surprised about some of the things that I found, and my view of him probably changed in the process of that. I guess as an historian, my main interest is in, broadly modern European history, but I'm particularly interested in Russian history and in history around the Russian Revolution. And to make a long story fairly short, back in the early 90s, I wrote a biography of a fellow by the name of Boris Savinkov, who I know most people have never heard of. He was a Russian revolutionary terrorist and an anti-Bolshevik. He ended up teaming up with a guy that some people may have heard of, a guy by the name of Sidney Reilly. There was a whole mini-series with Sam Neill playing Reilly. So I went from writing a biography of Savinkov to, in the late 90s, writing a biography about Reilly and his world. And Reilly, circa World War I, was running around New York City, involved in all kinds of nefarious intrigues, as he usually was. And I knew that Crowley was in New York City about the same time. So Reilly is in New York City, and he has connections to British intelligence. And there certainly were stories, and one of the things that Crowley himself would blurt out on more than one occasion, and that other people would say was true, and other people would say he was just making it up, was that he, too, was in wartime New York, and that he was in some way connected to British intelligence. So I thought, it might be worthwhile poking around and just seeing if these two guys ever bumped into each other.
Yeah.
So I set off to Washington, D.C., to the U.S. National Archives, and to the files of a now-defunct intelligence organization, basically, which was then called the MID, the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Division. And one of the things handy about essentially defunct intelligence agencies is that sometimes their documents actually show up in public domain, and in this case, all the MID investigative files are in the National Archives. And so I just wrote to the archives and said, is there anything there under Crowley's name? And sure enough, a little file popped up, and I got a copy of that. And that contained, there was sort of one sentence. I mean, most of what was in it wasn't terribly illuminating. He was under surveillance, and they thought that he might be a German agent. You know, like, that's what I'd run across before.
Right.
But there was this one sentence that jumped out of it, basically, and to paraphrase that, it said that, you know, we've made inquiries in New York and that Mr. Aleister Crowley is an employee of the British government. And that basically, the Americans were told to back off, that he's working for us.
And this is World War One, correct?
Yeah, this is World War One. This is, by this time it's about 1918.
Okay.
And he spends the whole First World War in the United States. He arrives in 1914. He doesn't leave until after the war is over. He doesn't go home until 1919. So he's there for almost 5 years.
Okay.
So here I had this thing that, you know, we historians are always kind of looking for. We're always kind of looking for a document that will actually give us a little smoking gun. So here was a statement that he actually, you know, from, and this came from the British consulate, that he's working for us. That, of course, left open the huge question that, okay, what exactly is he doing, and what would be involved in this? So out of that, basically from that basic discovery in that MID file, I wrote a short article, which was just also called Secret Agent 666. I like that title so much I use it for the book.
It's a good one.
And that was, I couldn't come up with a better one. And that was published in a journal, basically an academic journal on espionage topics, the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence. And one of the things about publishing things in academic journals, for anybody who may be curious about that, is that it's probably one of the best ways in the world to ensure that virtually no one ever sees it. I've sometimes, you know, had the sneaking suspicion that academic publishing largely exists in order to hide things, but at any rate, but in this case, that didn't happen, and this was almost certainly because it had Aleister Crowley's name connected to it.
Right.
So, you know, there are these people around the world who will see anything on that, and so the article sort of took on this little life of its own, and it actually, what people began doing is posting it to various websites. You know, the internet had come along, you know, quite illegally, I'm sure, of course, it didn't make any difference to me, but they would keep posting it around, and, you know, people would send me messages with questions, you know, and many of these were, what they boiled down to was that, are you going to do any more with this? Because, you know, the article itself was pretty much that, well, here he is in New York, these are some of the people he's connected to, and there must be a better picture. I didn't really initially plan to do any more with it than that, because, again, it was a kind of side angle to a completely different book and biography that I was working on. But I got enough feedback on it, and this is the type of thing that, you know, that sort of encouragement works. And eventually it had to do with the amount of feedback, and also along with that feedback I had people who were offering bits and pieces of information, and I eventually sort of got prodded into going, well, okay, let's go back and visit the whole thing. Let's not just look at Crowley in World War One New York. Let's go back and look at his whole career and see, because these allegations of his connections to the intelligence sphere, all the way from his activities in the First World War up until the Second World War, his name is frequently invoked in connection to the Rudolf Hess case. So maybe I should sort of not just look at those, I should look at the stuff in between, and I should go back to the beginning. And in doing that, I embarked, and you know, this thing, it becomes a kind of very interesting journey and learning experience. And I found out, and this is one of the first things that was surprising, is that throughout at least his adult career, and from the time that he was a student at Cambridge to the end of his life, Crowley is continuously connected to people who are linked to intelligence.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that every single one of them, you know, was necessarily linked into it, but he's sort of surrounded by spooks. And you would probe into these connections, and there was a lifelong link to that sort of world. Now, what that brought up is something that, you know, may strike some people as very odd, and it initially sort of struck me as odd. What on earth does this espionage, what does the world of intelligence have to do with the realm that he's generally connected to, which is occultism? That actually turns out quite a bit. But it's one of those things which is not as... Let's put it this way. It's one of those things that you have to be aware of and look for, and if you're not aware of it, it will just sort of go past you. And I began to find more and more connections between those two realms, and in a way, rather than being this sort of freakish oddity, let's say, in the intelligence world, probably sort of fits right into it. There's a pattern in this. Not to make direct comparisons, I mean, you can find, there was a book that came out, I think just about the same time as Secret Agent 666. It's a book on Houdini, and I should have it sitting on my bookshelf here somewhere. It's something like The Secret Life of Houdini. I think it's Sloman and Kalush. But one of the things that they reveal in this is that Harry Houdini, a very different type of magician, let's say, maybe not so different, had his own connection with British intelligence. In fact, was recruited basically to do a little spying when he was in Germany, and did so. So you've got Houdini's involved in it. Let's see, there was something else. There was a book that my wife got me for Christmas, believe it or not. It's a book called The Official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception.
Okay.
By H. Keith Melton and Robert Wallace. But what it's fundamentally about is the way in which in the 50s, the CIA sort of hired this, a stage magician, I guess, by the name of John Mulholland. And what even makes this more interesting is that Mulholland was linked to the CIA, and he was linked to MK Ultra.
Yeah.
So you get magicians, mind control, Harry Houdini. So, I mean, those are just other examples that you can find.
Well, also, Dr. John Dee, the astrologer, wasn't it the 16th century, was involved in some kind of like proto-intelligence agency, I believe.
Yeah, Dee was an intelligencer, is what they called him, for Queen Elizabeth I.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, in addition to, you know, speaking to spirits, was involved in collecting intelligence. And one of the things that someone, I mean, this is maybe the way to sort of understand how Crowley and his occultism fits into this, is that one of the things, well, let me go back a little ways. Occultism is, I think, certainly, let's say, in late Victorian and in Edwardian England, was widespread in British society, and particularly in the upper echelons of British society.
Right.
So I'm including here, you know, everything for, you know, if you look at one of the earliest groups that Crowley was connected to, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, that included people in the British art scene. It included people pretty much from the upper classes.
Right.
And from the political classes. So there are influential people within British and other societies who are very interested in those topics. And one of the things that occultism, these organizations, did is that they allowed people who might otherwise not seem to have any connections, people from politics, people from literature, people from theater, people from intelligence, to mix together and to, in effect, work together in ways that you wouldn't see. It provides this kind of hidden connection, this nexus within society.
Right.
And an example of that, and I think a very important fellow in Crowley's career, was a close friend that he had by the name of Everard Fielding. who I mentioned quite a bit in the book. And Fielding was the younger brother of the Earl of Denbigh. Okay, it doesn't mean that much to you or I, but let's just say if you're the younger brother of an earl, you're again from the upper crust.
Right.
Or very near to the upper crust. So Everard Fielding was, he sort of played two roles. Prior to the First World War, Fielding for years was the secretary of the Society for Psychical Research. And that was a kind of broad, spiritual, paranormal, what we would call it now is a sort of paranormal investigation organization.
Okay.
It saw itself in some ways as the sort of the equivalent of the Royal Geographic Society. The Society for Psychical Research was formed back, I think, in the 1880s, 1890s. Again, attracted the attention of people from sciences across society. Not what you would expect is a collection of sort of insignificant kooks. They may have been kooks, they may not have been. They weren't insignificant.
Right.
Fielding was the secretary of this society, and one of the things they engaged in was a lot of investigation of, particularly of spiritualism and of people, you know, of mediums. This is also how they sort of connect together with Houdini, who gets interested in this as well. And they exposed a great many of them. And others they thought might be legitimate. They were interested in what they saw as a sort of scientific exploration of, again, what we would now call the paranormal.
Right.
Crowley is a good friend of the Fielding. And in fact, in the years before the war, Crowley participates in some of these investigations. And it really quite objectively. I mean, he was someone who came to this. It's worth saying that he generally speaking, detested mediums.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that if you look at the general views of Houdini and you look at the views towards spiritualism of Crowley, whatever the other difference is, there's a kind of convergence of opinions on that. So Crowley and Fielding and the Society for Psychical Research are there before the war. When the war breaks out, Fielding goes into intelligence. And he spends the whole First World War in one branch or another of British intelligence. And he's the fellow who essentially recruits Crowley for his wartime mission. He becomes, in effect, Crowley's case officer. Because whenever Crowley runs into trouble, even if he's in New York, somehow he always manages to get back to Fielding. So here's this continuity between a peacetime, paranormal, investigative society field of the friendship between Crowley and Fielding, which during the war turns into a professional relationship linked to intelligence.
Okay.
And those are the type of things, I mean, that's maybe the single best example, but there's the same sort of connections that run through much the rest of Crowley's life. Most of the people, in the 1930s, for instance, towards the end of his life, Crowley is closely connected to a fellow by the name of Robin Thine, guy I'd never heard of before. I'd actually run across Fielding's name in a couple places, but Robin Thine, he proved to be a very difficult character to pin down. I mean, it was hard to figure out exactly. You would get these references that he died suddenly in the mid-30s, but then it was very strange and convoluted to figure out what it was that he died of. Or where, or other circumstances. Thine is one of these people who had some, you know, the British government was very, very interested in him. Somebody went to great expense to fly in a doctor from Switzerland to try to keep him from dying. Thine, again, is one of these people with intelligence connections as well. So from the beginning, the early part of Crowley's life till the end there, it's this, it ebbs, and flow. I mean, there are periods, I think certainly in the book, and through much of the 20s, Crowley's kind of an outcast. And there are things I suggest that he probably screwed up on. I'm not sure he was the best secret agent that anyone could possibly have.
He had a few too many vices, I think, to be too good at it.
Well, I think that he was distracted by a lot of things.
Right.
You know, heroin addiction was one of them.
Yeah.
His various adventures in romance was probably another as well. I mean, Crowley was... I'll go back to this thing that I mentioned to begin with in terms of how my views towards him changed. And I think certainly by the time I was finished with the book, I felt that, well, you can always claim that you have more understanding of someone, you know, which is easy to do, just claim that when you've never actually physically met them. But nevertheless, as much as I could, I think I had more understanding of him, not again so much from his interest in the occult, but just as a person. I had a lot more sympathy for him.
Okay.
But that isn't saying that I'm totally sort of won over to his side. He was a guy with a lot of vices. And, you know, I would tend to agree, let's put it this way, if I was, I would not loan him money.
Yeah.
I would probably not, I would never let my daughter anywhere near him.
Yeah.
Nor my wife. And I sort of agree with the people, someone who once said that they would, you know, they sort of liked him, but they would never leave their children alone with him.
Right.
And, you know, again, he was extremely self-centered. To the point of absolute cruelty to people around him. He was a guy who managed to burn most of the bridges he had. He was a difficult person.
Right.
And very few of his relationships endure through his life. And I think that was certainly one of the things that made him problematic as an intelligence asset. But on the other hand, what made him useful, I think, right up to the end, near the end of his life, was that he had connections, that he had access to information that other people didn't have, or they didn't have, they couldn't get quite so easily. And there again is an example of this that I note in the book. This is, it's around the mid-1920s, when he's living in France. He hasn't gone back to Britain for years. And actually appears to be very reluctant to do so, and probably nobody much wanted him to do that, and he's been down on his leg. It's a very low point in his life. But there's some documents that crop up on the British side, and the sort of conversations between the Foreign Office and a fellow who's in British intelligence, in fact, had been involved with MI6, and They're curious about basically this Russian mystic, a guy by the name of Nikolai Rerich, which some people may have heard of. And he's also connected to intelligence, by the way. But Nikolai Rerich, they were suspicious of him because they thought he was, in his explorations in the Himalayas, was a Soviet agent, which they're absolutely right about. And they were trying to get information about him. And so they approached this one fellow, and he rather reluctantly says, "Well, I know a guy, you know, Aleister Crowley, who has a lot of information about Asiatic dreams and mysticism, and he probably can give us some kind of insight on that." Now, here again, I'm sort of paraphrasing, but that's roughly what he tells them. But you know, this certainly meets a great deal of opposition. There's a lot of, you know, reluctance. It's like, I almost don't want to mention his name. But if you're really sort of looking for this, he, you know, I might be able to get a hold of him and see what he knows. And you can clearly see in some of the other exchanges, it's like, well, you know, other people sort of want to hold their nose. Others make it clear they want absolutely nothing to do with him.
Right.
And I think part of that had to do with his reputation, which by this time point was quite bad. But I think it's also connected to some sort of reservations to, you know, about his usefulness. But still, to give that type of information, the point was, there's only sort of one guy that we could go to who might be able to help us, and whether we have to hold our nose dealing with him or not, whatever else we may think about him, he is a potential asset. And I think this is one of the things that sort of draws him back into, I think it's Crowley's connection to German occult circles that brings him back into the intelligence fold about the beginning of the 1930s, and is one of the main reasons he's hanging around Weimar Germany as the Nazis are coming to power.
Right. Can we, there's a, I was taking notes while I was rereading it, and I think there's a maybe we could go through kind of biographically and just mention a few episodes where he's kind of in a curiously in a place of importance.
Yeah.
For the British, like maybe to start with the you kind of theorize that perhaps his splitting up of the Golden Dawn had to do with his intelligence duties.
Well, and that was, again, one of those things that really surprised me, because I wasn't expecting to find much there. And people who are acquainted with his career, and I don't want to presume too much, but the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, or just the Golden Dawn for short, was a kind of specialized takeoff on Rosicrucianism, which itself was a kind of takeoff, or a specialized takeoff on Freemasonry, and Crowley himself sort of passed through those organizations as well. And that came together again at the end of the 19th century. He joined it in the late 1890s. I mean, the organization had been around for a while. And it had its, like most of these groups do, it had its personal differences within it. It also had some doctrinal differences. It probably would have come apart at the seams anyway, but what I began to note, and just sort of standing back and looking at it, is that Crowley comes along, he's promoted into the organization, especially this fellow by the name of Samuel MacGregor Mathers, sort of, who was one of the old men of the organization's champion, and moved him along. Other people in the Golden Dawn thought he was moving him along too quickly, didn't like Crowley personally. And eventually, the tensions that he didn't necessarily create, but which he brought to this peak, tore the organization apart. And it never really recovers from that.
Right.
And so, you know, Crowley enters the Golden Dawn, and in short order, the whole thing blows up. And most of this has to do with him. Now, that could be one of those things that, you know, it's just a matter of personalities clashing with each other. But then I began to explore a little bit more into some of the political affiliations of the Golden Dawn. So the question was, is there more here than just interest in occultism?
Right.
And that's where you began to find out that MacGregor Mathers and others, there was a whole current running through the Golden Dawn that might roughly be called Celtic Revivalism. So this is where you can find people who are connected to, there's a lot of Irish nationalism within it. And there's also Scottish nationalism. But within that, there's also something that I didn't really expect to find. There's what in British politics is often called Jacobism. If anybody knows their English history, back before the German Georgies came along, you know, George I, the II, the III, all those ones we're familiar with slightly, there were the good old Tudor Stuarts, going back to Henry VIII and his dad and Elizabeth and the rest, and that dynasty is overthrown in the 17th century, but its adherents always believe that the House of Hanover are a group of German usurpers. And this is, and there were actually, if you go back to the 18th century, there are rebellions in Scotland and even in England in an attempt to restore the Stuarts to the throne. And it was one of those things that I sort of imagined, you know, must have run its course, you know, back in 1750. Well, it turns out there weren't many of them. But into the 19th and even the beginning of the 20th century, there's this restorationist current, this legitimists they call themselves, and these were people. MacGregor Mathers is one of them who wants to restore the rightful Stuart dynasty to the British throne, and they keep that rather low key. But that also combines together with this revivalist Celtic nationalism, Irish nationalism, and it also reaches out and connects with other legitimist movements across Europe. And one of these connections is to replace the king in Spain. And And in fact, throughout the 19th century, Spain had been sort of torn apart by civil wars over which basic branch of the Bourbon family was going to rule the place. And this is where I find out that Curley is mixed up at about the same time that he's involved with the Golden Dawn in this, today it would be like a Bay of Pigs operation. You had British legitimists who were helping Spanish legitimists acquire guns in Germany and to ship them into ports in northern Spain to raise a rebellion against the British government. And in fact, Curley in his book, his Confessions, makes some allusions to this. He goes that I was sort of along for the ride. But what is he doing there? That was one of the questions. What actual role did he have? He claims to have this role in this plot. He also, even later when he's in Mexico, he gives this note about being working for Don Carlos, the Spanish pretender. So he uses his connection to the Golden Dawn connects him to a kind of political underground of gun running and political intrigue in England and in Spain, and actually connects him to a plot to foment a rebellion in Spain and overthrow the government. A plot, of course, which is betrayed and fizzles. And it's one of those things that I can't say. I don't know whether he's the person who betrayed it, but on the other hand, nothing that he touched involved in any of this comes to pass. And at the very least, I think that his presence inside that organization was to gather, if you look at the rest of his career, that he was involved in this, and that at least he may have been interested in the mystical wisdom that the Golden Dawn could present, but he also was performing another task, which was to find out what these people were up to, and I also think rather strongly to disrupt their activities as much as possible.
Yeah, it's a really intriguing spin on the situation. I mean, I've been aware of Curley for years, and I've read much more of his writing than writing about him, which I think a lot of his critics would probably do well to do. I mean, I agree he was a lunatic in many respects and a monster. But the point I'm trying to make is after reading your book, I see his whole life in a different light. It's not a good or bad light. It's just much more interesting. He's that much more interesting to me now, because I guess I never would have suspected that he would be in the employ of the Secret Service or the intelligence agencies in Britain. But it kind of makes sense. He kind of would make the perfect spy in a way. He could have been.
Well, in some ways, it's his sheer flamboyancy that recommends it for the task. Somebody once pointed out to me, I think I mentioned in the book, that in some cases the best recommendation for a job of that kind is to be someone that no one thinks would do it. I mean, particularly if you were going to be involved in, let's say, clandestine activities where your actual motives are supposed to be kept secret, then if you're someone that no one would ever suspect doing that, that makes you ideal for it.
Right.
And I think the simple idea that someone might argue that the British would never employ a man of this fellow's reputation, actually is a pretty good reason to employ him.
Well, he also he was very fond of assuming aliases and different costumes, and I think I read somewhere that he actually, when he was in China, he donned like a costume and tried to pass himself off as a Chinese something or other, and some type of
he liked dressing up. There's one episode which is one of those things I'd really like to know more about, but it's again when he's in the U.S. during the First World War, and one of his British compatriots that he meets there, a guy by the name of Lewis Wilkinson, a writer who might have had his own connections to intelligence, who knows. At any rate, he's palling around with Wilkinson and staying in Wilkinson's house. I think Wilkinson lives in Philadelphia, and much to the annoyance of Wilkinson's wife, it's a woman by the name of Frances Gregg, who just absolutely hated Curley, which a lot of people did.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things that she later recounted to her son, which he wrote, was that she claims that she walked into their house one day, and Crowley was like in the middle of, I can't remember, he was putting on or taking off a disguise. And, you know, she couldn't figure out what it was that he was doing in her house in the middle of the day, in, you know, donning this disguise or removing it, and it just sort of absolutely terrorized her, and she supposedly had nightmares about this incident for the rest of her life. And, you know, she might have been a little impressionable in this case, but I have this very strong hunch that she sort of caught some little aspect of Crowley's behavior that, if we knew more about it, if I could ferret out more about that, it would give it clear ideas to some of the things that he was up to in the U.S. And I think that physical disguise was a part of it. And, you know, this was a guy who even wanted to make himself invisible. And I think he actually writes that he thought he'd almost pulled it off a couple of times. And, you know, so that's one of those things that you would think of, all right, this is an occultist goal. This is what the magician would want to do, to make himself invisible. Now, if as a practitioner of the arcane arts, if you could make yourself invisible, that would be a great achievement. But imagine the practical value that would have in espionage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just a little indication of where those two worlds sort of together.
Well, he was also not, you know, he spent, I think, the first, 35 years of his life living off an inheritance, and he was very well-traveled, very good with languages.
Yes.
And, I mean, if you read anything by him, he displays an encyclopedic knowledge of history and cultures, both contemporary and ancient. And those are aspects of him which seem to also make him somebody who would be a great spy.
Well, he had brains. The other thing about him is that he was brave. Right? And the guy had guts. He would put himself into dangerous situations. He was, you know, the other thing that I think a lot of people often miss about him, which is sort of covered by his occultism, is that early on he was a world class mountaineer.
Yeah.
You know, he's going into the Himalayas, you know, the climbing these peaks. I mean, it was a physically robust guy. This is also the sort of image you have of him later on, this kind of bald, Buddha-like fat man. And certainly he, you know, he kind of let himself go. That happens to all of us at one point or another.
Yeah.
But even in his later years, he's still, I don't think he could have kept going as long as he could have. He wasn't, a fairly large, strong man, a guy who was willing to take risks. I mean, he was willing to put himself into dangerous situations. In most of those cases, he's got all the kind of makings of a secret agent, or someone who could see. And I think, into some, even in that regard, let's say if the situation called for it, the requisite ruthlessness,
yeah,
that might be necessary.
The dubious morality.
Well, you know, it's a, if occultism has its sort of, let's say, dubious morality, then so does the clandestine world.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that you have to do in that realm is you have to lie. Deceit is one of those things. It's been sort of one of the ones, you know, in let's say, broadly speaking, the world of intelligence, not only is deceit is acceptable, it's absolutely required.
Right.
Much of what you do is deceiving. I think, you know, lying, to put it another way. That's really a kind of art that's involved. And I think Crowley's own kind of personal morality was something that wasn't in conflict with that at all.
Yeah.
The other thing that sort of fits in with that, and again, one of those things I didn't expect, I actually sort of came across that first in the article, is that, you know, however contemptuous he was of, you know, of ordinary society, sexual mores, moral attitudes as a whole, there's very clearly a side of the man in which he is he's a very patriotic Englishman.
Yeah.
In his own, perhaps twisted way, but nevertheless, it's I think there's this one statement, and again, relates to the First World War. I mean, he's saying that, you know, I don't think that the English pot is any less black than the German kettle. In other words, I don't think there's any real moral difference between the two, but the point is that basically I'm an Englishman, and therefore I will be loyal to England. I think, but, you know, mine is the loyalty of Bill Sykes' dog.
Right.
And you know, my master may beat me and starve me, but nevertheless, he's my master and I love him. And it's kind of, I don't know, almost sort of a masochistic relationship he has with Britain.
Yeah, it's one of the most curious things about him, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I don't understand it. But.
Well, there's got to be something. I think I noted there that, you know, this is as a child, he's raised in what we would now describe as a strict Christian fundamentalist household.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that sort of drove into the quasi-diabolical or not, but it's, you know, he grew up basically in a kind of religious cult. And, you know, and it seemed to me that there's a certain continuity in that he spent much of his life trying to form his own religion. And his father was a lay preacher. And Aleister Crowley, in his own way, he saw himself as a prophet and as a preacher of a new kind of religion. And, yeah, he's a mass of sort of fascinating contradictions. And it's one of the things that I'll admit that through much of working on the book that I tended to deliberately avoid was becoming too closely or really sort of soliciting relationships with Crowley's organizations, especially the various branches of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. And there were people who were Thelemites, and I might add that virtually every one of the people, you know, of Crowleyites, Thelemites, whatever you want to call them, who offered comments or help were entirely nice, very regular people. I mean, they were extremely helpful. A couple of minor exceptions to that, but as a whole, the problem there is that, as probably some people will realize all too well, is that the Crowley movement, or the, I don't know if the movement is the right term for it, that among the followers of Crowley in the world today, there are sectarian divisions, and there are personality clashes and arguments over who holds the rights to this or that. And it's one of those things that I was aware of and to some degree warned about, and I wanted to try to avoid getting drawn in to some sort of sectarian, you know, that if we help you, then you can't take help from them. And actually, that never came up in a sense. But I was trying to navigate those shoals as much. And also, in a way, I want to sort of make up my own mind about it.
Yeah.
And not be too influenced by anyone else, and especially by someone who, for better or for worse, would describe themselves as a follower.
That may lead us into one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, I mean, this book is just relentlessly researched. I mean, it's just so full of names and dates and you know, obviously facts, and it's refreshingly free from any kind of like armchair conjecture about the man. It's kind of great that there's no kind of moralistic agenda to it. You really allow the reader to decide what they, you know, think about him. But what I, in reading it and rereading it, I was just, I'm sitting there thinking the whole time, like, God, how did this guy research this? I mean, it's just, how long did it take you? Where were you researching? You know, how much, you know, of your life did you have to invest in it? Because it just seems like it would have been a lifetime worth of.
Well, it didn't take as long as the Riley book did, because it wasn't going off quite as many different directions. You know, I had some basic research I'd done for the article, but of course there was a lot more that had to be added to that.
Right.
I wrote the article about 2000. I probably got really heavily into working on the book around, it altogether probably took me about 4 years.
Okay.
There were times when I would take breaks. I mean, that's one of the ways that I found that I have to work, is that every now and then I have to get away from it. And let it sit there for a while and then come back to it. But it was, I don't know, what, if you're really interested in the topic, you don't fret. It's not like work. It's
right.
Actually fun.
Right.
And I don't know, there's probably some more, you know, sophisticated academic way, but actually it is, it's fun.
Yeah.
And because I would, you know, come across these things, and you run across these puzzles. My wife, probably has some insights into my behavior, has insisted that I'm a sort of obsessive puzzle solver. And that's what I like. I like these sort of, you know, why are these people doing this? How can I sort of figure out what's going on? And that was what looking at Crowley's from this aspect of trying to reconstruct something, trying to figure out what his motivations were or what they might have been. You know, you said the thing about conjecture. I mean, there are. You know, I'll admit that there certainly are places where I will speculate upon what he might have been doing, because it's pretty clear he's doing something. So what might that have been? But I'm not trying to force anything to a conclusion. And then the one thing, I think, as I say in the introduction, is that I'll always try to make very clear between the things that we absolutely know, the things that, if you look at the amount of evidence, are almost likely, you know, which you could say appear to be the case, and then there's things that might be. And that's sometimes going to be the most interesting, because there's, and I don't think it's unfair to bring those types of things up. I mean, to simply raise the question is that, all right, it could be this, it might be, you know, what exactly was his motivation? Something is motivating it. Part of this has to do with the nature. And a lot of the other research I do, I spend way too much of my time trying to run down spies. And as I've sometimes explained with some frustration to colleagues and to others, is that when you're dealing with trying to reveal the history of things that were never supposed to be revealed, it's not like other areas of historical inquiry.
Right.
And I think it's one of the things that sometimes people don't fully appreciate. You know, the secret services are secret for a reason. Much of the stuff that they do is never intended to be part of the historical record. It's certainly never intended to be a matter of public knowledge. And that may be because, you know, not necessarily that it's wicked or that it's, you know, morally questionable. It's a way of preserving institutional integrity. I mean, you don't want to, you know, if you reveal everything about how you operate, you're giving a lot of material away.
Right.
And it's one of the, you know, so dealing with intelligence history is really involves a lot of, I guess, roughly what could be called, for like, detective work. And it really often is trying to, you have to look beyond the surface. You have to realize that you're dealing with people and agencies that are involved habitually in deception,
right.
And therefore, you can't take anything at face value. And you're often, and sometimes you're left in a situation where all you can do is to hopefully intelligently speculate about what is taking place. And you might be wrong, but nonetheless, somebody else, if somebody can come along and take it where you left off, even in the process of proving you're wrong, then you've, I think, done what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, well, nobody could make the allegation that this book is light on facts and sources cited. That's one of the best things about it. Besides from the fact that it's so accessible, it's so well written. I think that anybody, you know, even if somebody wasn't interested in Aleister Crowley at the outset, could pick this up and be quickly fascinated. by the subject. Another thing I wanted to bring up, maybe just briefly, but I was fascinated to read in the book that Gurdjieff, G.I. Gurdjieff, might have, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, that he might have been an asset of the crown, so to speak.
Well, that's been alleged about Gurdjieff, I guess is the... Gurdjieff is Russian, although apparently there is this, I think I mentioned this rather bizarre idea that he's actually a Cockney pretending to be a Russian.
Right.
Which I don't believe. But you never know. It's an intriguing idea. Gurdjieff was another one of these sort of gurus who gathered his, you know, faithful followers around him, and he got started in Russia, and then he ended up in France. Some of his followers, people like Sir Paul Dukes, certainly was a fellow connected to British intelligence. He has some of those. I think the other fellow, one of his close associates, a Britisher by the name of Bennett, was another former intelligence officer. Who, interestingly enough, if you look through some British documents, is suspected at the same time he's connected to Gurdjieff as being connected to the Soviets. And that's the other act, the innuendo or allegation which is made. Some argue that Gurdjieff was an asset of British intelligence. There are those who think that he was an asset of Soviet intelligence. And then there's also that third possibility that he's an asset of both.
Right.
Which, actually, among the people I look at, is more likely the case than anything else. I don't really know. I mean, you know, I haven't looked at Gurdjieff that closely. I'd say that there are, again, for some of the same reasons that Crowley would fit into that. Gurdjieff is a man who could draw people to him. He had influence. He could access information. He certainly moved between the Western European and Russian worlds. He would have fit right into that environment. So I think that's an intriguing possibility that somebody ought to look at more closely.
Another thing, the Lusitania. You mentioned in the book that I think it was the woman who was the curator of Morgan's library in New York. He mentioned some, he kind of brought up, like, well, I'm sorry, what was her name?
Belle Green,
okay. I believe you said in the book that he kind of jokingly brought up that they could sink a steamer and that would bring the U.S. into the war?
Well, probably the Lusitania is, I think most people know, is this big British, the pride of the British liner fleet, torpedoed off the coast of Ireland in 1915, 1,000 or so people drowned, 100 or so of those are Americans, almost brings the U.S. into the war. Does it? The U.S. doesn't come into the war until about 2 years later, but it gives the Germans a PR black eye that they never recover from.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, the Germans... It takes them a very long time to realize that. They actually were quite proud of their achievement, and one of the reasons they were proud of it was that their insistence at the time that the Lusitania, in addition to being a passenger liner, was being used to carry war supplies, which, as it turns out, it was. It was being used to carry partially assembled shells, rifles, etc. So the British were cramming war material into the liner and sending it across the Atlantic, which made it actually legal to sink it.
Right.
Or at least it. But nevertheless, it looked very bad, you know.
It was like the Pearl Harbor of World War One.
Yes, it's nothing like drowning a lot of civilians. Even if you could argue that technically you could get away with it. But Crowley, his connection to the Lusitania sort of begins that when he comes to America on Halloween 1914, I always love that fact, he arrived in the U.S. in New York Harbor from Britain on October the 31st aboard the Lusitania. So
right.
He comes in on Halloween on this doomed ship.
Right.
Now, it's still got some months around. The significance of that, though, is that one of the things that the Germans would claim that they would add to their justification of sinking the Lusitania is their argument that it was carrying guns. I mean, that it had hidden below decks naval guns that could be brought out and mounted and then used against submarines or other German vessels. That therefore it was a warship, and that made it even more. And then this was one of those things that if you could, you know, if it actually did have guns on it, that would have changed the perception perhaps.
Right.
Now, one of the interesting things about Crowley coming over on the ship, and then he subsequently, you'll notice if you read the book, very quickly sort of insinuates his way into the German organization in the U.S., and particularly into their propaganda outlets. One of the things that he could attest to, having been a passenger, was that, yeah, I saw guns aboard the Lusitania. He could therefore, the Germans already believed this, and he was, I'm not certainly saying that he's the only one, but he is one more voice that could have credibly argued that, yes, you're absolutely right. In the same way that in fact, when the Lusitania, I think, comes over to New York on its last voyage before it goes back to be sunk, one of his girlfriends, Lila Waddell,
yeah,
comes over on that one. So he could trot out Lila to go, yes, she saw guns as well.
Right.
Crowley's basic job in all of this, his actual function among the Germans in America was to be a kind of agent provocateur.
Right.
And the thing that a good agent provocateur does is that he doesn't get people to do things that they don't want to do. He gets them to do what they want to do.
Right.
He convinces it's the right thing. And this is where I think that among many other factors, I mean, you can't, and those, I don't say that Alistair Crowley is responsible for sinking the Lusitania. He was anywhere near it when it went down. But what he did do is that he gained access to German councils and propaganda cabinet in New York, which in turn fed information about American attitudes and the value. One of the things that Crowley tried to sell the Germans on was that you should intimidate the Americans into neutrality.
Right.
You know, that the Americans are sort of, you know, they're children in world affairs. And basically, if you show them how tough and determined Germany is, they won't dare enter the war. And so something actually like, you know, in essence, show me that you got the balls to sink this liner that the English think that they can stick rifles on and you won't notice. That will make the Americans think twice about getting into the fray. And that's something that on the German side, that people of their own arrogance, let's say, were quite willing to accept. Even though, in a sense, it's again this rule of deception. Crowley, the British agent, is pretending to be a German propagandist and egging them on to do something that they want to do, but in the end will be disastrous for them and will be one of the biggest propaganda boons the British. I mean, the British couldn't get the Germans, it would have to help the Germans screw up that battling. And that's really where Crowley contributes to that situation.
Right. It never made much sense to me why, of course, before your book, there's not really too much good information on him writing this German propaganda for the Fatherland. But it never made any sense at all to me that he would. I mean, looking back now with hindsight, that just smacks of some sort of operation going on, that he would be writing for this German propaganda. You know.
He was writing for the preeminent German publication in the U.S., the Fatherland, you know, which was as pro-German as you could possibly get, and the articles that he writes for it are, well, let's put it this way, they weren't mild in their criticism of Britain. I think his later explanation for it is in that case perfectly honest. He goes, look, these things are sort of over the top. They're more anti-British than even the Germans can manage to come up with.
Right.
They're inflammatory to the point of almost being a parody. And that's a way to look. If you go back with that in mind and look at some of the articles that he's writing, they are parodies. The bottom line of this whole episode, though, is that truly in the U.S. through those 5 years, you know, writes things and has associations that, by any stretch of the imagination, should have ended him up in a British prison for years if they'd ever gotten a hold of him.
You know, that's actually specifically a question or something I wanted to bring up, not to interrupt you, but it's pretty amazing that he never got, I don't think he ever spent any time in a prison cell.
No, they don't touch it.
Which is just amazing, because he was notoriously, like, you know, any time that they wanted to search his apartment, I'm sure they'd find all sorts of, you know, illegal drugs, and I mean, they had many reasons to toss him in the cellar for, or in a cell for, you know, his whole life.
Well, it goes back to that little sentence that jumped out of that MID report, is that he was an employee of the British government. That's why they didn't touch him.
Right.
In fact, here's something that when I was writing the book, it was a little detail. It was one of those little factoids that I couldn't run down, but which I have since. So, it has to do with it. When Crowley goes back to England at the end of 1919, I think in the book I say that, you know, we know when he gets to England and when he leaves, and you know, it's either going to be this ship he went on or another ship he went on. And one of the problems was that I couldn't locate the passenger manifest to one of these ships. A ship called the Lapland, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah.
And eventually I found it. And the whole thing is that it actually was misfiled. Those things happen. But I found, and there he is. And this is the thing. So he actually returned to England in December 1919, having spent those years in the U.S. writing pro-German propaganda. He returns under his own name.
Right.
He did. There's no disguise. And furthermore, he had to be carrying a British passport because of wartime regulations, and that wasn't the passport that he would have gone over on, because that would have had to have been changed, which means that the British consulate in New York approved his return.
Right. And so
was
there a law at that time that he could have gone to prison, like for treason or whatever, for what he was writing in the States?
I've talked with people about, you know, who, you know their way around British law, and going back to that period. It's not quite as cut and dried as it would have seemed. They could have tried to have made a treason case against him. Whether they could have, because it's based purely upon what it was that he was writing. And you might say that it was inflammatory and it was in bad taste. What he didn't do, as far as I know, in any of these, was to directly attempt to subvert the loyalty of the armed forces, or advocate the defeat of the country, although he comes very close to saying that. Given the circumstances, I mean, a lawyer can parse this. On the other hand, what everyone pretty much agreed on is that in the immediate post-war environment, if his publications had been brought in for a British court, and, you know, he would have been convicted of something.
Right. Okay. That's all I wanted to know. I mean, would have been brought before a court, he probably would have done some time for that.
Yes, they could have made things very unpleasant, or he would never have dared. And notice the thing is that he goes back to England when he leaves the U.S.
Right.
This isn't Hyde up. So he goes to the passport, what was called the passport control office at the British consulate, and this is the little detail that's always good. And guess what agency oversaw the passport control office? Intelligence.
Okay,
passport. In this period, the passport control office was the front for MI6.
Okay.
All right. So those two things are all. I mean, the passport control office did just basic passport work, but it's also what MI6 was sort of hiding behind.
Right.
In most of these. So they knew fully what he was doing. If they wanted to arrest him or quit, they don't do anything to him. And
didn't he? I think you actually quoted him as saying something like, in his smug way, saying something that to the effect that he asked them to give him any, he basically, like, asked to be arrested if they had anything against him. Like, he almost, like, offered himself up.
At one point, in fact, during the war, this is around like 1917, and he's upset about something, which part of it is he doesn't think he's being paid enough. And he always had money problems.
Right.
But he actually makes this threat that I went to the, you know, he goes to the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. to complain. And that's also kind of interesting, that he walks into the embassy in Washington, D.C., even though he had this reputation of being a German propaganda, a quasi-traitor. And he mentions that I was going to go to Canada and force them to arrest me.
Right.
And what that seems to mean is that, remember, the Canadian government is separate. All of his writings, anything that he had written, had been banned in Canada. The Fatherland was banned in Canada. He was on a list in Canada of enemy propagandists.
Right.
So even though British authorities in the U.S. knew what he was doing, if he went to Canada and exposed himself, the Canadian authorities would probably have arrested him. And then what that would have done is that it would have embarrassed people in London or in Washington who would have had to go to the Canadians and explain to them what he was doing and get him out. And that's basically what he's threatening to do, is to embarrass British officials by getting himself arrested in Canada.
Right.
He is violently attacked in the British press. Which is actually, he returns to England right after the war. He doesn't stay there very long. And I think the reason for that is that he's told that, you can't show your face around here because there are people in the press. He had this particular enemy among the British press barons, a guy by the name of Horatio Bottomley.
Right.
And Bottomley just sort of, went out. He was driven to near hysteria by Crowley and what he did. And so he very quickly leaves and goes to France, where of course he meets his old buddy Everard Fielding, and more hijinks ensue. But that's the British officialdom, or at least certainly had, let's say the security services were not going to touch him, but they didn't want him in the country because his mere presence there would excite Bottomley and other people in the press. What if they start asking questions?
Right.
And then what they, of course, and what no intelligence agency would want to get forced into the position of doing is to avowing, to really stepping out in public and go, this most wickedest man in the world, he actually works for us.
Right, right. Can we kind of right now get into His presence in Italy and the Abbey of Thelema in Cefalù, because that seems to be a perfect way the Abbey's presence there kind of co-opts his ability to spy on not only Mussolini's Italy, but also I think there was something about him spying for France about ships coming in and out.
Or spying. Well, this is one of those things that, again, all of these little rumors sort of
right
around. And there was, so that again in 1920 apparently, and I think most of this was on his own idea, he wanted to form his own religion, his own church, and so he bought this farmhouse on the north coast of Sicily and invited some of his followers, a couple of girlfriends and their kids and some other people to which it sounds a lot like a hippie commune, actually.
Yeah.
The 1920s version of that. So he sort of forms his commune, his Abbey of Thelema, in Sicily. But here again, it's one of those things that you find about anytime he shows up in a place, there's usually some real, or at least potential, intelligence value to it.
Right.
So he shows up there, and of course, in the course of his time, Mussolini takes over in 1922. The fascist government comes in. Fascist government is not keen on a lot of things, and they're not keen on Freemasons, Rosicrucians, or any other sort of weird cults operating in their territory.
Right.
But initially they sort of leave him alone. So the various sort of rumors about the intelligence aspect is that, one, that he was actually working for French military intelligence, spying on Italian naval installations around Palermo. Another was that, no, he was spying for maybe for the British, which is what I think is probably more correct, like his usual employers, against the French. Because one of the things he would do in Sicily is that he'd make these trips back to Paris, and he'd make these trips to North Africa, to Tunis and Bizerte. And Bizerte was a very important French naval base in the Mediterranean, but it was also something else. It was the point from which French troops in North Africa were being sent to the Middle East. The French had taken over Syria, and there were a lot of British-French tensions in that area of the world. And so one of the things the British were quite interested in was, you know, what the French were, the forces the French were sending or might be sending into Syria. And that also fits back in that, guess where his buddy Everard Fielding had been spent most of the latter part of World War I? Syria, in the Middle East. So who is it that he reconnects with in Paris shortly before he takes off and establishes his Sicilian commune? Everard Fielding.
Wow.
I don't know. This is the type of thing you look at it and you figure, are those all coincidences, or is there a certain chain of events here?
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, there was one thing. I don't know if this is going to lead us off topic or not, but there was a curious detail that jumped out at me, was that there's this woman, Violet Gibson, who tried to assassinate Mussolini.
And yeah.
You said in the book that it seemed to somebody at the time that she was maybe, there was some post-hypnotic suggestion going on with that.
Well, I think it's something that was claimed in her defense in the trial. Violet Gibson, again, she's English or Anglo-Irish. I think she actually turns out, you know, this is about the same period that that Ireland had gotten its independence or quasi-independence. She takes a shot at Mussolini, misses him, and goes on trial in Italy, but it's one of these cases where it was sort of assumed at the time that there was more behind. You know, it's a classic sort of lone nut. I mean, was this just a sort of strange woman who came from Ireland to kill Il Duce, or was there something more to it than that?
Right.
And there are these. I mean, she's got connections to the Theosophists.
Yeah.
And that's another group which seems to have that really would sort of lead us off topic. Theosophy, at least, I mean, I don't know what all the wonderful theosophists are doing today. I don't want to draw any aspersions, but in the 20s, and particularly under the leadership of Annie Besant, who was again connected to the Indian independence movement, theosophy had ties to, well, not just the sort of seditious movements within the British Empire, but because of that, to some degree, with Soviet influences. There's a lot of currents moving through there.
Right.
And
the Nazis also drew heavily on theosophical ideas.
Yeah,
not to paint the theosophists with that, but, you know.
Well, again, I don't want to draw too many connections between what was going on in an organization, you know, decades ago and one now.
Right.
But it's one of the things, you know, that if you're interested in those movements, you know, if you're someone today who's interested in theosophy, it's like the Golden Dawn. It's not just all rituals and mystic knowledge. There's almost always some kind of political dimension to these groups. And again, Annie Besant is a very political woman. She had very definite, strong, and radical opinions. The British government, you know, considered her to be basically a dangerous subversive, and she was certainly someone they would want to keep an eye on. And Crowley and hanging around, you know, he's never a theosophist himself, but in his connections with him, I think that's basically what he's doing. The Violet Gibson case is one of those things that, you know, there are all of these other ramifications to it, the theosophist connection, the intimations that that in some way, if British intelligence was sort of watching what was going on, and I think that's something. I think the role that Crowley had in that as elsewhere, to the extent he had an intelligence role in Italy in that period, was basically just to be a set of eyes and ears.
Right.
That again, one of the things that he knew by this time, or they assumed that he ought to know, was that he was experienced enough and intelligent enough to know what kind of information that people in London would be interested in.
Right.
And that he would be able to collect that information and send it back to them. And since he had followers, mostly from Britain, constantly coming and going, that provided a perfect means to do that. And again, you know, you've got this bunch of English weirdos living here on the beach running around naked. Well, you know, who's going to take them seriously? Well, most of them are just there for their own spiritual purposes, but it's also a good way to sort of convey information back and forth.
Right.
One of the guys that he's connected with there is the British, a guy by the name of McBean, who's the British consul in Palermo, which is just down the road. And you start looking at McBean, and what's McBean? Well, he's a mystical Freemason. In fact, he's one of the fellows who refounds the rite of Memphis and Mizraim in Italy, and he also if my memory is not, he's a great admirer of Antibesant and Theosophists.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, I have to say, and that's still something where I have to look at it, and I'll say this, I'm quite confident that there's much more going on than meets the eye.
Yeah.
But as to exactly what the hell's going on, I don't know.
Right. Right. This is getting out of order here historically, I guess, but another one of the episodes of his life, which you write about in the book, that was really interesting to me, is his trip to Mexico and his kind of handing over Mexican oil via this 33-degree Freemason and the then dictator of Mexico, who was also a Freemason, Diaz. You kind of allege in the book that he had a hand in kind of handing over the sale of Mexican oil to BP, or the British Petroleum?
Well, what will become BP?
Okay.
It's one of those things to look for, and, I mean, this is something I'll go back, I was, this is another sort of, I guess, upfront disclaimer I should put into this. I've never been a Thelemite, and just in case anybody's interesting, I'm interested or speculates on this, I'm not now, nor have I ever been a member of any intelligence organization.
Okay.
Not me. No. Of course, if I was, I could tell you. No, but anyway. No, I have not really. No, I haven't.
Right.
And it's just because I'm interested in those sort of things that I get asked that. I have, you know, casually or not, I've met people who have, and I've gotten some interesting encouragement. Sometimes I've not gotten encouragement, but I would count. And one of the things that, let's say, someone who spent many, many years in operational intelligence pointed out to me, he said, well, if you're looking into this stuff, you know, if somebody if you're sort of wondering what they're doing in a particular place at a particular time, you know, it may just be coincidental, but look at what else is going on. And that's the question you would ask yourself. Why is this person in this place at that particular time?
Yeah.
So if we go back, I think, you know, this is the early 20th century, well before World War I, Crowley's in Mexico. And this is one of the places where he tries experimenting with making himself invisible. But there's a couple of things in that trip. One, he's there at the same time that British interests are busily gobbling up the rights to most of Mexican oil. And for which there's a very lively competition with the Yankees to the north. And others interested in that are the Germans, but the British really sort of come out on top in getting the advantage in gaining control of Mexican petroleum at that point. And this is under the old Diaz dictatorship, and Mexican politics in that period and even later were heavily influenced by Masonic affiliations.
Okay.
And that's one of those things that, again, it's like Theosophists. I'll put it this way. I'm not a Freemason either. My granddad was, though. And I think my dad was for like a week. I don't know. But, I mean, I never attended it. So, no funding. And this is one of the things that that Freemasons often get rather defensive about, because they always feel as if they're defending themselves, and, you know, that they're being accused of being the Illuminati and plotting to take over the world. I don't know. But it does, I think there are a lot of exaggerated claims about the influence of Freemasonry.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, in looking, and I particularly found this in, if one looks at, you know, my particular interest is in Russia, if one looks at Masonic lodges in Russia before and even during the revolution, I don't think it has anything to do with Masonic doctrine. But the point is that what Freemasonry does in places like Russia, Mexico, or elsewhere, in the revolutionary, in the colonies, in 1776.
Right.
What Masonic lodges provide is that they provide a secure environment in which like-minded people can come together and conspire.
Yeah, and usually powerful or upper middle class, at least, people as well. Yeah.
I mean, they might call it talking about politics, but, you know, at some point, talking about politics can cross a line into conspiracy.
Right.
But this is where a lot of political plots are hatched, and you know, it's interesting that, you know, the Crowley shows up, and I think it's Don Jesus de Medina, who's one of the top Scottish Rite Freemasons there, who then initiates Crowley into the lodge, and Medina is connected to the dictator Diaz, and I don't know, was maybe he trying to get some inside information? Okay, see, that's something that, as an initiated Freemason, as someone who gets initiated into this secret society that the dictator is part of, that would give you an access to information or to impart information that others might not. So I think that his presence there wasn't just to go and climb mountains. I mean, I think in a lot of things Crowley is combining his personal agenda with it may be that his idea of going to Mexico was all his own, but then someone like Fielding or someone else will argue that, well, since you're going to be in Mexico anyway, perhaps you could sort of talk to this person, or perhaps you might see what you could find out about this or that.
Right.
It's also the same trip where he's still carrying on some kind of connections to the pretender in Spain. Then he still sees himself, and so he's still playing at being an agent for the Spanish legitimists. Now, how that fits in, that's a completely different angle, I don't know. And that, again, is a little detail I only came across after the book was out. But it certainly means that would be an indication that Crowley saw part of his mission in Mexico as involving political intrigue and not just sort of a cult recreation.
Right. There's another, I might be grasping at straws here, but there was somewhere in the book where you mentioned that he took kind of a magical retreat up to Montauk, and I believe that Montauk, it's kind of a center of high weirdness in a lot of different respects, but I think it was on some History Channel documentary or something, that Montauk was the site where a lot of Germans set up camp in the interwar period, and there were a lot of German community centers, and they would do marches and stuff. I believe that Montauk was the place where there were a lot of Germans in a pretty thriving pro-German community of immigrants.
So the sort of Bund, like the Nazi American Bund in the 30s?
Yeah, I think so.
The only thing I get connected with it is that it's not right at Montauk, but fairly close to it, just a little ways down the Long Island coast. I keep thinking the name is Amagansett, but I'm probably not pronouncing it right. During World War II, German saboteurs were basically landed next to Montauk Point.
Okay.
I mean, you're right that it is what, you know, Montauk is, is the extreme far eastern end of Long Island. If you just keep going to Long Island until you get out there and you get the ocean, then you're in Montauk.
Right.
It gets, there's a whole, I make some allusions to them in the book. It gets into this whole, you know, that Montauk is some sort of giant underground base, that it's in some way connected to the Philadelphia experiment, which, right. You know, is this warship, this supposed... There's all kinds of really bizarre things that are alleged about Montauk. I haven't been to Montauk. I've actually talked to a couple of people who have been there in that country. Both of them found it to be completely unremarkable.
Right.
But it was like, well, no, we didn't see any monsters, and there were no UFOs. But maybe they just weren't there on the right day, or they weren't thinking the right thoughts. I don't know. I'll tell you that I gave more of the sort of backstory of Montauk, or said more about the place and things in the initial draft. That was one of those things that was sort of excised. And I did that because, in part, my editor really wanted me to excise it. But beyond that, because I said it was just a distraction, and it wasn't. I wanted to keep things as much as you can. And this will sound sort of strange, dealing with Aleister Crowley, to keep things down to earth in a way, there didn't seem any particular reason to bring that in, other than to basically say this is an area associated with higher weirdness, and one of the things that people will always bring up in that is that, yes, you know, Aleister Crowley camped there. And he did this twice during his American stay, I probably notably, one in the summer of 1918 when he went up the Hudson River, camped out on an island, and then in the summer of 1919...
Was that where he painted Do What Thou Wilt on the side of the cliff?
Yeah, there's like painting stuff all over the rocks. It's also very, very close to Franklin Roosevelt's family home.
Right, right. Hyde Park?
He's actually in this area where there are all of these sort of, you know, elite estates. It's really not that isolated, the Socas Island. It's in sort of the middle of a rather important area. That's what got him investigated by American authorities. Because for one, they got reports that this guy was a German propagandist, and here now he's suddenly out on this island doing weird things.
Right.
That itself is another. So again, it's another case where the reason why he's on that island is not just accidental, and it's not just a matter of spiritual exercises. And if it fits the pattern, in other words, if you look that his presence at Montauk is it really because it's that isolated? And that's the first impression you get, that he went all the way out to the end of Long Island because it was too hot in New York and he wanted to get away from everybody. But then when you begin to look closely at it, you find that at that particular point in time, Montauk was not the place to get away from anybody because it was one of the most heavily militarized areas on the American East Coast.
Right.
There had been, now a lot of this stuff was being demobilized, that the war was over, but there was still a naval seaplane station, and which would eventually become a naval research station. And it's one of those places, I think I have this in the book, that even in the summer of 1919, the war had ended months before, there's still, at Montauk Point, there's this naval station, and one of the things which is even noted in the papers is that there's still about 100 guys there. Okay, there are still military personnel, and while everything else is being closed down, this particular naval station is still underway, and the question was, well, why are these guys being kept there, and what's going on now that the war is over? And there's not much information. Well, there's just some activities going on here, and we need these people to do that. And in fact, the place never really closes down. It goes on to become a torpedo experimental station, and then an electronics experimental station. And it actually is what eventually grows into this Montauk base that people then subsequently associate all of these, everything from mind control experiments to time travel experiments. But there is this sort of naval experimental thing there. Now, So that there's a lot of military activity going on, and there's naval experimental activity going on, and that's what I think Crowley was doing. Now, he may also have been relaxing and taking time to get away from New York, but he was also positioned in an area to, in effect, spy upon what the Yankees, wartime allies that now were, I think I put it this way, you know,
rivals.
One of the main reasons that Britain had got, maybe the main reason that Britain had gone to war in 1914 was that Germany threatened British naval supremacy.
Yeah.
Germany was the second biggest naval power in the world. In order to defeat Germany, Britain, with the help of Crowley and many others, brought the United States into the war. Now, with Germany defeated and the German Navy destroyed, who was the second biggest naval power and greatest rival to Britain?
The States.
The United States. And when you keep in mind that countries don't have friends, they have interests, now was the time to figure out exactly what it was the U.S. Navy was doing there. Now, one of the little, and this again sort of falls in the realm of just sort of synchronicity and connections. There's somebody else who a few years before, in fact, right up until 1917, had his own sort of experimental station on Long Island, now towards the middle of the island, and that was Nikola Tesla.
Yep.
And the U.S. Navy, this is one of these things that I found fascinating, it was the U.S. Navy that in the summer of 1917 that comes in and dismantles Tesla's tower, blows up his tower. And why did they blow up the tower? Because the argument was that they had rumors that it was being used by German agents to communicate with submarines and with Germany.
Right.
And I also found it interesting that the first thing in that file, in that American military intelligence file, the first reference to Crowley in it is a kind of little cryptic report from the Office of U.S. Naval Intelligence dated July 1917. So for some reason, Crowley's name came up in U.S. Naval Intelligence in July 1917, which is precisely the same time that they're dismantling Tesla's lab at Shoreham, Long Island.
And just to add in there, a little fact is that the importance of that tower is that Tesla wanted to use that to provide free electricity to the world or something?
Yeah, he thought that he could, as I understand it, I don't claim any great expertise on Tesla, but that he could essentially draw electric current and concentrate it and then broadcast electric power.
Right.
And that is supposedly why his funding fell through.
Right.
Because J.P. Morgan or someone asked him, well, this is great, where do we put the meter? And he goes, well, there isn't any meter.
Yeah, I think it was Westinghouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
But it's interesting to me that Tesla's stuff, and I don't know how much of the stuff there, basically ends up in the hands of the Navy. So here's where you can play around with an interesting scenario, and I this is no more than just sort of an interesting idea. What happened? And I couldn't find this out. What happened to the machinery and the other things removed by the Navy from Shoreham or Warden Cliff? What do they do with it?
Yeah.
Nobody seems to know.
Yeah.
One possibility, and just sort of, this sort of intriguing thought here, is that one of the things that you would have to make use of anything from Tesla is lots of electricity. One of the things about Montauk and the Montauk Naval Station is that it's at the end of the electrified Long Island Railroad. Therefore, even though it's way out of the end of Long Island, it would have an almost unlimited supply of electrical power. So, did anything that had been taken from Tesla's lab end up at Montauk? And is that, I'm intrigued by the idea that there may be, and you'll often find among all these bizarre theories about Montauk, that what you had was that this was some sort of research station, and it was a research station that you wanted to keep secret, and one of the ways of doing that actually is to spread a lot of disinformation.
Right.
There is something I think that your listeners, anybody want to keep in mind, is that goofy an outlet, or let's put it this way, ideas that make anybody who brings them up look like a coup. There's a way, it can be a way of shielding something which isn't quite as dramatic, but nonetheless needs to be hidden.
Exactly.
So that there may be a much simpler story behind all of this, the mystery of Montauk. But I think Crowley was curious about what, or somebody was curious about what was going on there. And he was a veteran operative who sort of did his thing and poked around.
Well, in the interest of time, I think we might need to kind of wrap this up. You know, I could talk about this
sure.
with you for hours and hours, but basically, well, first of all, it's a fascinating book. It's really, really, really well written.
Thank you.
I mean, this last time that I reread it here this past week, I think I read it in two sittings. I just couldn't put it down. And it's definitely one of those books you can go back and read many more times and keep extracting more and more out of it because it's so chock full of events. But so just saying that aside, what's coming down the pike for Richard B. Spence?
Well, I don't know. There might be an occasion in the future to do a review, you know, not drastically, but there's some more material I could add to a revised edition of Secret Agent 666. I'm not saying that would necessarily happen anytime soon. The other things I'm involved in, I'm actually involved in a project I can't say too much about now which is a kind of historical murder mystery it's set in 1915 California, which sounds a little strange, and I'm not. It would also be an interesting story how I got involved in that. But one of the things about it is that he doesn't play a big part, but one of the guys who sort of passes through the action that's going on there is Aleister Crowley.
Okay.
Sure enough, he turns up in it, and there's some interesting connections to him. Other than that, I've sort of turned back to working at more of my assorted spies that I'm trying to retrieve from historical obscurity. One of them is a German by the name of Kurt Jahnke, which is mentioned, I think, in Secret Agent 666.
Yeah.
And Kurt Jahnke is probably one of the great unappreciated secret agents of the 20th century. So I have got a biographical work on him, which is underway, and also one that I've been working on off and on. The first American spy chief in Soviet Russia, a guy with a very unlikely name of Xenophon Kalamatiano. But never that. Do you remember who was the first American spy chief in Russia? Xenophon Kalamatiano.
Huh.
So there's his story is sort of mixed up in a book I want to put together on sort of early American espionage in Russia, and then also the flip side of that, which is early Soviet espionage in the United States. And I found, you know, there were Bolshevik spies as early as 1918 and 1919. And how that was working out. I guess the grander topic is the thing I like to call the secret history of the Russian Revolution, which sort of goes back, I guess, to my real area, the central area of interest, which is trying to figure out what's going on in Russia between, in 1917 and 1918, there's a lot of Freemasons in that.
And there's that bit about Lenin being kind of funneled through Switzerland on a train or something, I believe.
Well, it touches the more important figure in that. Okay, the guy that I'm the most interested in, and one which, frankly, I've got to dig deeper into, isn't Lenin. It's the fellow who actually arranged to propose the whole idea to the Germans, one, to subvert Russia through revolutionary agitation, and then also specifically to put Lenin and some of his buddies on a train and get them back to Russia in 1917. That's a man who's almost erased in history by the name of Alexander Helpand. or he's generally known as Parvus. Sometimes he's called Alexander Helpan Parvus. It's Parvus, I'd argue, more than Lenin, more than Trotsky, who's the real architect of the Russian Revolution. And the real question in the case of Parvus is exactly who he is and why he's doing this. And Parvus has connections that go out. Well, my old friend Riley is connected to that. He's close. He's the kind of mentor to Trotsky. Trotsky had a millionaire uncle who funded a lot of his activities. And that's really what I want to try to get at there. And,
well, that sounds fascinating.
Well, it keeps me off the streets.
Yeah, it's good. But as I already said, buy the book. Get on. Where should people get the book from?
Well, probably the simplest way to get it is through Amazon or Barnes and Noble.
It was obviously released by Feral House. So
Feral House.
Go to Feral House and get it there, which is one of the best publishing houses in the world, I would say.
Publishers of much interesting and occasionally weird material.
Yeah, they're great.
But always fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Richard B. Spence, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and also thank you so much for writing this fascinating book.
Well, thank you, Andy. Thank you for the nice things you've said about the book, and I hope anybody who's interested will have a chance to look at it. It's been my pleasure speaking to you and to your audience, and good luck to you and everybody else.
Well, it has been very much my pleasure as well, and have a good evening.
Bye.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Panopticon thanks Dr. Richard B. Spence for taking the time to speak with us about this amazing book, Secret Agent 666. Again, get on Amazon, get on Feral House, buy it. It's great. And have a good evening.